welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito. Thanks for listening. On today's show, episode 34, a very special episode. My interview with author of the recently published book, Schadenfreude, A Love Story, as well as an online columnist in many places, Rebecca Schumann. Let's get right to it. So how exactly does this interview fit into Pete's Percussion Podcast? Over the course of March, there was something going around social media called hashtag tripod, T-R-Y-P-O-D. It was a way to get those who currently listen to podcasts, like you, my audience, thank you, to get their friends to try podcasts out. Well, my good friend and former groomsman, Patrick McDonough, told me in advance that he was going to promote my podcast with this hashtag. His angle, getting the college job. His promotion, and this is from one of his tweets, are you an academic seeking a tenure-track job? Check out this podcast on getting jobs in a small specialty. Hashtag tripod. The tweet included a link to my show page. I was, of course, up for that. Then he tells me that he's going to specifically promote it to a writer from Slate.com whose beat is higher education. My reaction? Cool. I'm at work a few weeks ago, and I'm not paying attention to a conversation being had on my behalf on Twitter between Patrick and today's guest, Rebecca Schumann. I decide to add a brief comment into their Twitter conversation, which prompts this text message a few minutes later from Patrick. Dude, you know it's important when someone begins with this intro. Dude, I think the Slate writer just asked you to do a special edition podcast, not about percussion. And then later, another text from Patrick, after a long text about why I should have her on my show. Go for it. See, sometimes it helps to have friends. After that exchange, I direct messaged Rebecca Schumann over Twitter and then eventually email to seriously gauge her interest in doing the show. And, as you'll hear, she was up for being on it. One of the major interests I've pushed on this podcast has been the process for getting the job. I enjoy hearing about the various ways people landed their current gig and what it took to get there. However, it hadn't occurred to me to hook people into this podcast from that angle. And Rebecca Schumann's feeling was, if I seem to be covering so many success stories, why not have someone who did not succeed in getting the big-time college job? Which is when Rebecca herself volunteered to be on their show. Rebecca is, as she states on the interview, doing a self-promoted podcast tour for her new book, Schadenfreude, A Love Story, about her love affair with German culture. The full title is Schadenfreude, A Love Story, Me, the Germans, and 20 Years of Attempted Transformations, Unfortunate Miscommunications, and Humiliating Situations That Only They Have Words For. Now, if you're in the academic field and have spent any time looking at or researching dissertations, that is a title of relatively average length. Rebecca writes frequently for Slate.com, The Awl, Chronicle.com, and is a dissertation coach, a profession we talk about in the interview. Her columns are frequently really funny and full of truth with lots of sarcasm. My kind of writing! We recorded this interview over Skype on March 30th, 2017, and it begins right now. Well, what I want to start with is I want to kind of go through, I was looking at kind of how this even became
yeah.
a thing.
Okay, good idea.
Yeah, so I'm just kind of looking through the Twitter feed, and I kind of copied and pasted so I could figure it out. So essentially you get contacted, or I'm not totally sure, so you'll have to explain this once I get through it, but So a good friend of mine, he was actually a groomsman. What's that?
I'm sorry, you cut out for a second.
Oh,
okay. You want to repeat?
Okay. A good friend of mine who's he was one of my groomsmen, actually suggested my podcast somewhere that you caught wind of.
He suggested it directly to me.
Okay. And so you are, so then you two are writing to each other about, you know, what types of stories and success stories. And then you say, you know, how do you stay realistic? And I'm going to get to that in a minute, but then, but where it comes to is we're kind of, I say like, everybody enjoys a real story and I try to give them a chance to tell it. And then you say, of course, but maybe some have some failures on so that their stories can be heard and normalized as the majority of applicants. Start with me.
Okay.
All right. So go ahead. Tell me like why it went there.
Well, because there are not a lot of people who, even people who've managed to crawl their way out of, you know, the hole, if they really wanted to have an academic job and it didn't work out. That's a pretty sad place to be in. It's pretty depressing because you've worked for many, many years, sometimes a decade, you know, sometimes even more, although luckily I wasn't one of those people. So you've worked for all these years for this one particular goal. And in my case, especially, I sort of lost sight of the world outside of academia. My background is in German studies. And so I sort of lost sight of the world outside of literary research and the university. And there are a lot of people who have that happen to them. In your field, it may not be as common because there are many other things that you can do as a musician besides teach music. But in, you know, German studies, that list is a lot shorter. And so I found myself what felt like at the bottom of a very dark hole and really ashamed too. I felt like I'd let all my advisors down and let everybody down. And just, I mean, I didn't even want to show my face. I was so ashamed. And so I actually decided to do the, you know, pull a sort of George Costanza in the episode where he does things in the opposite of all of his instincts and everything works out for him. And I decided to just kind of go nuts. And so I have a friend who at the time was an editor at Slate magazine, and he asked me to write a very honest depiction of my struggles on the job market for Slate. And so I did, not really thinking – I thought it would be Googleable, but I didn't really think of anything beyond that. And then it went viral, and for a very brief period of time, many people in academia knew my name, and it wasn't – not in a good way.
which article was this? Because I read a bunch
Thesis Hate Nuts.
Okay, yeah. That was the most recent one I read.
Was my first one.
Okay.
And so I suddenly became I was the most famous academic failure in the world for like two days. And so
two very long days?
Yeah, it was pretty surreal because at the time I was busy being, speaking of your friend the groomsman, I was busy being a bridesmaid at my sister-in-law's wedding.
So
it kind of wasn't my day. It was my sister-in-law Monica's day. And suddenly my whole life is blowing up because at the time I think, you know, I didn't even understand what Twitter was really. And I think I had 13 followers on it. Like I just, you know, there was no, and then suddenly people were hitting me up from all over the world telling me how stupid I was, basically. Like it was pretty surreal. And so because I've had that kind of trial by fire, that was 4 years ago, and I have since navigated that. I've gone from being a professional failure, as in a failure at my profession, to being a professional failure, like a failure as a profession. I kind of turned my failure into failure theater. And then hopefully went beyond it. Like I have all sorts of other things going on now. And one of those things is that I have a book out and I'm sort of on a self-booked podcast tour. And so I was like, I'm going to try to get on Pete's podcast as part of my podcast tour. This will work great. But so a lot of people who have failed in academia aren't necessarily about to go jump on a podcast and talk about how they feel about their failure, you know?
Sure.
But there are so many people out there, probably people who listen to your podcast and definitely – I mean, there are more people who don't get an academic job, a tenure track academic job, than who do.
Sure.
And so I want those people to know they're not alone, and because none of them are going to wave their hand and be like, I volunteer as tribute to talk very frankly about this. That's why I volunteered myself. It wasn't like I am a giant show off and I need attention and I want to be on your podcast.
Sure,
it was I'm volunteering myself as tribute because nothing could be as bad as it was the first time the first time I was public about my failures. Because at the time, I had nothing else going on in my life. Mm-hmm. Like, I suddenly burned the biggest bridge I'd ever had. Like, my bridge to academia was torched.
Right.
And I had no other job on the horizon. I had nothing.
So
it was pretty terrifying.
When you published that first piece, were you still at... were you still teaching at that point?
Yeah. Okay. So it was pretty funny because I was on the tail end of a 2-year postdoc that was a very spiffy one. It was called the ACLS, American Council for Learned Society's New Faculty Fellows Program.
Okay.
And it was really prestigious. Like, thousands of people applied. Mm-hmm. Many people, you had to apply to apply. Yeah. And so of the sort of 1,000 or so people who got to apply, mm-hmm. about 50 people got it. I was one of those 50. The fellowship was designed to get people who were in danger of dropping out of the field to stay in as they waited for the market to bounce back, but it didn't bounce back. The ACLS got a grant from the Mellon Foundation. So the Mellons paid half of my salary, and then where I got placed, which was, I had actually 3 offers. It was the only time I've ever had multiple offers in my life as an academic. But for the postdoc, you get accepted for the postdoc, and then your name gets into kind of a clearinghouse of the anointed, and the participating institutions pick. And so I actually had offers from Ohio State, Case Western, and Columbia, and I chose Ohio State because I was being strategic, and I thought that that department would be the most likely to have a tenure track opening.
Okay.
And most likely to be the kind of place where I could get a tenure track job with my profile.
Okay.
And neither of those things turned out to be true. Not only did they not have a tenure track opening, but they were not interested in having me there on a permanent basis, which was a little bit of a surprise to me because it felt like they insinuated that they might have been when I was choosing between my multiple offers. And so I had some very nice and very great relationships with some colleagues at Ohio State. And then I had some kind of non-existent or rather hierarchical relationships with other people. Mm-hmm. And so I really didn't feel like I owed them anything. I didn't think I didn't really get much out of the postdoc there, mm-hmm. all in all. And so it was really funny because it was the last month of teaching there. It was really, I think I had 2 weeks left of teaching when thesis statement came out.
Yeah.
And at the time it came out, I happened to be playing hooky for a week. I took an entire secret week off from teaching because 2 different people got married in the same week in like far-flung, warm, tropical locations I wanted to go to. So the first wedding was on a Monday at Disney World, and the second wedding was on a Friday in San Diego. And so I was like, forget it. I'm just putting my classes online. So I took one day's classes and I just put them online, and because we were allowed to do that if we got sick or something.
Yeah, yeah.
So I put one day's classes online, and then I had another day where I scheduled an exam when I didn't kind of need to be scheduling an exam. And I got a grad student to proctor it for me.
Nice.
Yeah, it was a real bastard move on my part. But at that point, you know, I was like, this academia has ruined me, so I might as well get And the best part about it was that for the wedding in San Diego, I also scheduled a talk for myself. I'm a Franz Kafka specialist, and there's a Kafka archive out there.
Oh, okay.
So I reached out to the woman who runs that archive, and I scheduled a talk. So I had a small research allowance from the Mellons, and so the Mellons actually paid for the second trip.
Nice. I was
the whole thing was really awful of me to do, but also kind of, you know, don't hate the player, hate the game. But so not only was I terrified of what my colleagues at Ohio State were going to say, but I wasn't there. I was in San Diego playing hooky.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was like a little. And then I just sort of hid. For the last 2 weeks I was in my office, I just sort of hid. Mm-hmm. And the people who knew what was happening knew what was happening. They were, if not supportive, if not supportive of what I had written, they were supportive of me and in my endeavor in the world.
Sure.
I snagged my literary agent on the basis of thesis statement. So at the time I had big dreams, mm-hmm. That would not be realized for another 3 years.
Sure, yeah. But,
so
your friend, so it sounds like your two weddings didn't have the gall to at least schedule it maybe in Disneyland instead of Disney World. And, you know. But, you know, hey.
Then I could have just driven between them. Exactly. And taken a whole week in California.
And gotten it paid for, apparently. So there you go.
Yes. Yeah, well, I paid for the trip to Disney World myself.
Yeah.
So.
that's good. All right, it just sounds like you have 2 weeks left, and it's like torches are – everything is – you've set everything on fire.
Yeah.
And now you have these 2 weeks to kind of figure out your life?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, luckily, one of the things that Ohio State did to wrong me was that their general payroll system for faculty is completely fucked because at the time they had quarters, the quarter system, which I actually like. There's a big semesters versus quarters divide. It's like the great schism of our time. I'm pro quarters because I like doing my courses balls to the wall where we really don't pace ourselves and just like – I like doing courses. It's just this screaming adrenaline pace. Mm-hmm. It's great. And I like being able to teach 3 quarters worth of courses a year. But Ohio State, to get parity with other institutions of its – ilk and other institutions in the Ohio area, switched to semesters my second year there. And so my first year, I didn't get paid until November, even though I had been working for months at that point. Uh-huh. Classes started at the end of August. I had to move. For my first 3 months at Ohio State, I was like prepping my classes I had all new courses, of course, because you can never predict what you're going to teach when you're in grad. And the people are like, you should leave grad school with a stable of courses that you're ready to teach, and that way you won't overprepare. And I'm like, you can't do that because especially as a language teacher, every institution has its own very well thought out language curriculum that uses different textbooks and different approaches and stuff. And so you can't just be like, I'm taking this class I learned when I was a second year grad student in my curriculum design class and I designed it imaginarily. So I would be up until 1 a.m. every night prepping, sitting on a lawn chair that I got from Target in the like discount end of summer section for $1.99.
Oh, sweet.
So it was like me and my Target lawn chair in the middle of my echoing apartment. At 1 a.m. prepping.
Did it at least have a little coot, that little cup holder there?
No. That would have been that was outside of my budget.
That was a $3 chair.
And so, but the good thing about this is that because of the semester situation, they owed me 2 years worth of pay. And so on the back end, we ended in April and I was paid through August.
Oh, wow.
So I did have a cushion.
Yeah.
I had the summer to figure my shit out.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can curse on your podcast.
I put a little E on it.
So everybody's like, I know, this one's cool. this one's like the straight out of Compton of percussion podcasts.
It's like the Marc Maron where he's not cursing as the title, but you know what he is.
Yeah.
Particularly when he opens it, so.
I had the summer to kind of figure my life out, but the clock was ticking and I still felt like I had besmirched my name. Like I felt like I was completely, nobody was going to want to hire me to do anything because I was thesis hate my girl. And being a freelance writer at the time was not, that was, you know, thesis hate my. Unlike my academic publications, thesis statement did pay me, but it only paid me $250.
Okay.
So I was like, that's not enough to live off of for a year. I need to figure out something to do.
Yeah.
And so my rule was that I would not say no to anything. For an entire year, any opportunity of employment given to me, I would take. Mm-hmm. And so... Sorry, go on.
I was just going to ask, where are you at this point? Where you live?
Okay. So I left my apartment in Ohio. It was actually really, I kind of missed that apartment a little bit. So I had a long distance relationship with my partner of, I want to say 7 years. I can't remember how long we'd been together at that point, but okay. He lived in St. Louis at the time, okay. Still does, and was and still is a not full-time non-tenure track philosophy professor at a regional university up here. And so I moved back to St. Louis and moved in with him.
Okay.
And then we got married shortly thereafter.
Okay.
And then shortly thereafter, I got pregnant with our daughter. And so, because I had been kind of waiting to start my family and start my life until I got on the tenure track and had some sort of stability in my life.
Okay.
But then suddenly, that was never going to happen. I was never going to get that stability. And I was 36 years old. Mm-hmm. And I was like, Jesus, tap dancing Christ, I better get a kid. But if I want a kid, I better get one ASAP. and so I moved to St. Louis, and you know, the time in Ohio had really been detrimental to my personal relationship. And so I had some reparations to make. We both did, like, we just had some work to do on our relationship when I moved back, and it didn't help that I was like, didn't have a job and was moping around all the time talking about how I besmirched my name.
Right.
But so I just started saying yes to stuff. And the first thing I said yes to was this job that I applied to on an absolute fluke. One of my Facebook friends had trouble finishing his dissertation, and he had posted on Facebook that he employed something called a dissertation coach, and it got him over the hump. Mm-hmm. And of all the problems I had in academia, writing has never been one of them. And I wrote my own dissertation, not easily, but very efficiently. With a system that I thought worked pretty well for me. So I was like, geez, if this academia thing doesn't work out for me, I guess if a dissertation coach really is a thing, I should be one of those. Mm-hmm. So I found the most prominent dissertation company that I could find on the internet called the Dissertation Coach. And I cold emailed the founder and I said, I don't need a dissertation coach. I think I might be good at it. And she had no reason to think that this was the case, but she just sort of liked the cut of my chib. She just emailed me right back to send her my CV and a little more about myself. And so I did. And we had a phone interview the next week, and I was hired on the spot. And so, like, compared to the academic hiring cycle, that was just, it blew my mind to go from no job to job. In a week.
Yeah.
With no protocol other than sending a CV and a short description. There was no extensive dossier I had to fill out, no statement of whatever philosophy. I didn't have to get past any sort of committee. There was no conference I had to go to. So that was the good news, is that I was like employed again. But the bad news was that, I was basically running a private practice. So I had to get clients.
Right.
And that came slowly. But once it started coming, it didn't stop. And by the time I stopped getting paid from Ohio State, I had enough of a reservoir of clients to support myself.
Excellent.
And yet at the same time, I had reapplied to join the adjunct pool that I had spent some time in here in St. Louis before I got the postdoc in Ohio. Mm-hmm. And they had at first told me that they were all full and they didn't, all their courses were set. But somebody left. I can't remember who, but they called me in a week before class started and said, can you come in and teach this course that you have taught before? We have 3 units of it for you. And I was like, that's pretty much a full-time job, but sure. Mm-hmm. So I said yes. And so I have this like coaching stable of about 10 clients, mm-hmm. and suddenly a 3-course load. And then at the same time, Slate calls me up and says, I guess the higher ed market is very popular online. We have a big readership for all your pieces. Mm-hmm. Would you like a regular column?
Yes.
We'll pay you very little money and you'll get a lot of hate mail. Sound fun? And I was like, yeah.
Sign me up.
And so I went from having no job and feeling like I'd completely besmirched everything about myself to having 3 jobs. And I, with the 3 jobs together, I still made less money than I had when I was at my fancy postdoc, mm-hmm. but I certainly made enough money to put away some money for taking time off for the baby.
Right.
And just so I supported myself fine.
When you say, explain what you meant by adjunct pool.
So at most places, when you want to adjunct, you have to join a pool. It's like a typing pool, but it's for adjuncts. So you call up whoever there is to call up. These days, it's mostly HR, but sometimes it's the heads of departments or colleges.
Okay.
And you just add your CV to a giant stack. Mm-hmm. And if a course comes up at the last minute that somebody can't teach, they'll pull whoever looks the most qualified and basically just pull you in at the last minute to come do it.
Okay.
So that took for.
How long did you do that, or are you still doing that?
I just did that for one more year, and I would have kept doing it indefinitely, but I had a kid, and so there was no – the idea of paying more than I would be paid as an adjunct to put my child in daycare didn't seem like a good trade-off. So I stopped adjuncting to care for my kid, and she's still young enough that I'm basically still – like I would consider myself at this point like a 75% – mother person caregiver, and then for the rest of the 25% of the time I somehow managed to be a full-time writer. So I do like a full-time job worth of writing in very few hours a week at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just don't have time to dick around. Like if I have childcare, especially paid childcare, I'm like working with really manic laser focus the whole time.
What's required to get you in that zone of manic focused time?
My kid walking out the door.
That's it.
Flip the switch. I can't afford to feel like working. I just have to work. So I've actually gotten one of the reasons that I'm pretty good at coaching clients who aren't feeling like working is that I have a whole stable of tricks that I employ to work when I don't feel like working. I had to start doing that as soon as my kid was born. Cause I had a book. Toward the end of my first year out in the wilderness, I also sold my book. And so then there was four things suddenly that I was doing.
Was the book done or was it?
No, I sold it on proposal. So okay. It's a nonfiction book.
Yeah.
So that's par for the course with that. So suddenly I had to write that whole thing too.
How much time to do it?
I was given a year.
Okay. Did you have in your head a year's worth that you could spill out
it was all worth, I guess. I don't have any problem with writing productivity at all. So even with barely any time, I planned it out for myself. I basically turned it into a project management workflow and just did it. Just executed it. Anytime my kid fell asleep, especially when she was really little, I'd place her on top of my chest and my computer on top of her butt and just go nuts. And the content, the quality of the writing of that draft probably wasn't super great, but by the time I got it polished up, I think it turned out pretty good. You know, I wrote most of the book that's currently in bookstores with a child clamped to me in one way or another, and I managed to do it.
It wasn't easy
at all, but I did it.
Did you make that your promotional photo?
I wish.
Oh, you should.
No, they just made me use a photo of just me trying to look cool, and I'm not cool anymore. So, because a lot of the book is about when I wanted to be cool and was sort of cool, and so, but I'm not cool anymore. But yeah, so I went from having nothing and being like enemy of academia number one to suddenly having more work than I could handle. And I still, to this day, financially, I am hardly rolling in it. But I am, you know, more or less employed enough for my tastes at this point and would take on more if I could. At this point, I can afford childcare for my kid, but now they're like, oh, there's a waiting list for all of our pre. You know, it's pretty hard to get childcare, which I didn't know, but now I do, but it's too late.
There you go.
But now I do.
when it goes from you just doing the one, like the what was seemed to be a one off thing with the your thesis hatred piece to, you said more regular. Is that what's the, like, I mean, do they sit there and go, okay, we'll take a piece a month? Like, how, in terms of, like,
it was stuff with six slate. Pieces a month.
Okay.
And then it was up to eight.
Okay.
So, and that was like, I can't even imagine how I sustained that. I could only sustain that for, I think I sustained that for 2 years. And then I was like, no. So they said you have a quota of X pieces a month. And basically, as soon as you get an idea for one, pitch it. We'll take the pitch or we'll not take the pitch and then turn it in as quickly as you can. I mean, it's pretty breakneck. And especially for a publication like Slate, it's like mostly quick takes on the news.
Yeah.
And so you have to do stuff while it's newsworthy.
Sure.
And I've actually found that I can't really keep up with Slate pace anymore with my kid. And so I'm not a columnist at Slate anymore. I still write there, but it's only when I really have something that I can write that I know is right and that I can do. That's right for me. I don't have I couldn't sustain my quota, and so now I don't have one.
Got it. When you have pieces, I'm curious with something like Slate where there's so many inserts of you know, to links to everything.
Oh yeah.
Do your pieces do you have to send them with all the links enclosed?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
But that's where the research background comes so in handy though, because you know when you putting a hyperlink in a piece of short-form journalism is pretty much the same thing as putting a footnote in a piece of scholarly work.
Mm-hmm.
It's just your way of alluding to the conversation and making sure that everybody knows that you did your research and your due diligence. And, you know, it's a lot different when you only have 100 – when you only have, like, 1,000 words and you only have 4 hours to do it, you know, you can't be as – exacting as a 30-page scholarly article that takes a year or two even to write. Right. But I really was a very, and still am, an extremely diligent researcher with my journalism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not to say that I haven't made mistakes. I've made immense mistakes, and they've all been made in public. Mm-hmm. My learning curve at Slate was very steep, and I had all of my faux pas where everybody could see. And luckily Slate was very patient with me when I was dealing with that. Now, since Slate is mostly a political and news magazine, Slate's like just all about Trump all the time.
Sure, yeah.
So when I do have an idea that fits in with the milieu, it everybody's pretty happy to get it because it's like not a Trump thing. But it's hard to get a foothold in. But so when I decided, well, it was a sort of a mutual decision between me and Slate, but it was right about when my book was coming out that I wanted to branch out to other publications that were less about quick takes on the news. And so that's when I started writing a column for the All, AWL, as in the thing that pierces things. And that's the All is a great site that sort of like if Gawker, the now defunct Gawker, right. Yeah. were just like, smaller, smarter, and less celebrity focused.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's sort of the All's milieu. The All was founded, co-founded by Alex Bach and Corey Seeker, who was like the founding editor of Gawker. And Corey's not there anymore, but now the All is edited by Sylvia Kellingsworth, who's just fantastic. But the All said, you know, we want you to write about is Germany. And I was like, yes, that's my whole raison d'etre, to use a French word, about my German obsession. Like, I have an entire doctorate's worth of stuff to talk about that I really want to talk about, but I want to talk about it in a way that's fun to people. So my whole shtick at the All is to read the German news, find the most ridiculous thing in it, translate the salient parts of it, and then relate that to the larger German cultural milieu at large. And so now I'm sort of putting my dissertation, my PhD to use, I guess, in a completely different and weird way. But it's, everything sort of come full circle. And the only thing that has not changed the whole time is that I, once again, am not making very much money.
Sure.
That's sort of the life that I've chosen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, we tend to choose that if we decide to become college professors.
Yeah, for sure. That's the thing is that yeah, I mean, the general public, I don't think really, they sort of know a little bit about adjuncts now as professors who really don't make any money.
Yeah.
But then they think it's some sort of meritocracy and like, well, if the if the adjunct were better, they'd be full time and then they'd be making, and people think that, that professors all make like $200,000 a year, which is like, what? Right. No, even the fancy ones barely make that. Yeah. Like, I don't know.
Well, they'll use as their guidepost. They'll pick, you know, they'll pick something from New England for one, and then and then it'll be like the most liberal one in Connecticut or something, and then it'll be like they'll look for the full professor salary, and they're like, oh my gosh, come on.
Yeah, I know, but then it'll be like the full professor in the business school salary, right, or something.
Totally different.
Yeah, no, I know, but you know, there's a difference between not making a lot of money but still getting by and like making no money and really worrying about money all the time. And right. I'm very lucky in that I don't, largely at this point, because I'm married and the full-time caregiver of our kid. We're mostly living, well, I would say we live like on my book advance and my husband's salary pretty much simultaneously. Mm-hmm. But I hope I sell another book, because otherwise I can't really keep this life up.
Sure, yeah. So I want to – can we back up?
Yeah.
What gets – because – and this is, I think, going to be related to your book, which is about your love of German culture, right?
Yes, yeah, so one-sided. My love of German culture and German culture is very decided indifference back.
Which sounds about right, actually.
Yes, it's exactly right. They, you know, it wouldn't be German of them to have the passion that I have for them back at me. Then I wouldn't. If they had that passion back at me, I wouldn't want them like I do.
It's the unrequited crush.
That's the whole point.
Okay, excellent.
Yeah.
So, how does that develop when you're growing up? Or does it come later? Is it your
No, it started in high school.
Okay.
And so the book starts in high school too. Uh-huh. It starts in high school when I was young, like a sophomore in high school. Mm-hmm. My parents are both English PhDs, and so they have a lot of books at their house. Okay. And one day I was procrastinating my homework and I was looking through their books and I found a copy of Kafka's Metamorphosis and I was like, oh, this looks interesting. And so I sat down and I read it and I was very profoundly affected by it, but none of my friends seemed to care and nobody really wanted to talk about it. And then when I was a senior, I met this guy and he was really into Kafka, but he thought the Metamorphosis was like silly beginner Kafka, which is not true, actually. Metamorphosis is a very important work that has so many different meanings. And, you know, I've published scholarly articles and a scholarly book on, in part, the Metamorphosis. Like, it has a lot. There's a lot in it that isn't beginner Kafka. But at the time, this guy was like the smartest kid in my class. So I was like, well, if he says that, then I'll just read this other Kafka instead. And so I got this huge crush on this kid and started reading Kafka in more seriousness at the same time. And the two men who kind of looked alike too, they're both this sort of gaunt, dark-eyed, dark-haired Semitic, I'm Jewish too, so Semitic geniuses that nobody understood. And I was like, I'm a gaunt, dark-haired Semitic genius nobody understands. This is everybody. I wasn't really gaunt, but I am dark-haired and Semitic. And so I was really into this guy, and we dated really briefly, but it was a very epic romance for me because I was, you know, only 17 years old. And then he dumped me, and it was so awful. It was like the worst thing that anyone had ever done to anyone. Mm-hmm. And so he was gone, but I still had Kafka. And so I spent the whole summer before I left for college just like reading all of – I didn't speak any German at this point. Okay. Reading all of Kafka in English and just feeling really sorry for myself and being like, only this guy gets me. And so I had this plan in college that was basically just going to be like majoring in Kafka studies. I was going to do – everything was going to revolve around Kafka. And – part of that involved learning German, even though Kafka wasn't German. Where he grew up and lived for most of his life was Prague, which is now the Czech Republic, mm-hmm. but was part of the Austro-Hungarian empire when he was growing up. What's Czechoslovakia gained independence shortly before he died, okay. But it was Austria for while he was alive.
Okay, okay. What I just to place you, where are you living?
I'm in Eugene, Oregon, okay. Where I grew up, and I decided that I want to go to college at a at a small liberal arts college on the East Coast, knowing nothing about either of those two things.
Yeah, of course.
I went on a tour. My dad took me on a tour of colleges on the East Coast. And the most memorable part of the tour is that when we were waiting for our rental car in Philadelphia, do you know who else was waiting for his rental car in Philadelphia? George Carlin.
All right. I was like, a chance to guess.
George Carlin fan in the entire, like, I was probably his only 17-year-old girl fan in the world. But I was like agog. I just, because my dad really liked George Carlin too, and so it was like a thing we bonded over. And I could, like, of all the people to see, I'd never been to the East Coast before, and suddenly I'm on the East Coast, and there's like, to me, the most famous comedian and most important comedian in the world. And I was like, that's your call, that's your call. And so I also toured the campuses of a bunch of colleges that rejected me, but and one that didn't. And so I only got into one college. So the college search was very easy for me.
Okay.
I got into Vassar, and then I went and was like so culture shocked I couldn't even function my first year there. I just, being on the East Coast and away, nobody from my little high school in Eugene, Oregon went to that. I mean, people went to good schools. Mm-hmm. People went to better schools than Vassar. It's just that no one went to that one.
Right.
And so there's nobody from Eugene, Oregon in the entire school. Mm-hmm. And nobody understood me. And so once again, I was all, you know, broody and melancholic. And this was 1994. So I was also really, really cynical. Like very Gen X and ironic about everything, you know, like reality bites style. That was my whole milieu. And so basically with no experience in it and no real knowledge of any of the literature that I'd have to read, I decided to major in German without knowing any, because I knew that if I wanted to do Kafka studies, that's what I'd have to do.
Okay.
So I declared a German major halfway through my freshman year. Mm-hmm. I was doing really well in my German 101 class because mm-hmm. those are really easy. And also I am pretty good at languages. I do have a facility for that. So I spent the summer after my freshman year in Germany bumbling around, like not speaking German very well and just being like, I'm in Europe. I'd never been in Europe before. It was like the best thing that had ever happened to me in my life. Mm-hmm. And I made a lot of fairly bad decisions during that summer, and so many that it didn't even fit into one chapter in the book. It had to be divided into two. No, three. I'm wrong. That summer actually got three chapters in the book because there were two different stupid things that I did in Germany. And then also I took a trip to Prague where I was like trying to commune with the ghost of Franz Kafka, but instead I ended up having a one night stand with this rando who's like, was a real idiot. He was really smart, but he was like a jerk. So I don't mean idiot.
So you brought some boneheaded decisions with you to another country.
Absolutely. I would say that it was like peak bonehead was because I was on my own. You know, my parents just were like, well, you're 18. I guess you can go do this yourself.
Yeah.
And I was like peak bonehead. And so throughout college, I was sort of an underachiever and didn't do very well in my German courses. But I did manage to get myself back over to Germany for my junior year abroad, where I, again, didn't try very hard in school, but did make a lot of German friends and sort of try to immerse myself as much as possible in the Berlin sort of post-reunification, post-punk, post-squat scene, which was incredibly fun. Not super academic, but so that's another couple of chapters of the book. Mm-hmm. And then the book skips 8 years because I lived in New York for 8 years and didn't really have much to do with German stuff.
Okay.
So there's like a lost 8 years that maybe will be another book someday, because during those 8 years, I actually got married and divorced and did all sorts of other weird shit that didn't make it into the book.
Yeah.
And went back to Germany a couple times just, you know, for other reasons, but they just weren't as the trips weren't formative. So they just didn't fit with the arc of the book and they got cut. There was also I spent an entire year in Austria during graduate school that didn't get into the book. So there was like, some people have read the book and they're like, not that much of it takes place in Germany. And it seems like Rebecca's only been to Germany for like a year total in her whole life.
Yeah.
And the book does kind of look like that, but that's not true.
Okay. What are you? So, I just to again clarity. What are you doing for that 8 years? Are you just kind of freelancing? Or are you doing?
Oh, yeah. So I'm working in publishing, trying to become a writer. So I worked actually in the same building for the same publishing house that published this book.
Okay.
But that's our just completely by chance. That had nothing to do with them, but they didn't know that when they bought their book.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I worked in publishing. I worked in magazine publishing. I had a whole string of very glamorous but very badly paid media jobs at which I did a bad job. While I was, and I was like, I don't care. I want to be a writer. Fuck it. This is all just life experience. The idea of having a career trajectory and ascending the ranks somewhere and becoming like middle and then upper management was terrifying, like just vile to me. And I never considered doing it. And that is how I ended up almost 30 and deciding to get a PhD. Cause I was like, why not? All my other decisions have been terrible. Why not do this?
Not knowing it might have been a terrible decision, but you didn't know that yet.
I did know it was a terrible decision and I did it anyway and figured I'd figure something out by the time I was done. And unfortunately the thing I figured out was that I really actually did love German literature and wanted to be a professor of it. And that's like the worst possible thing I could have figured out.
when you do go back and you do start doing graduate work, is it, I don't see, and I, not knowing your field in that depth, are they just saying, are they basically breeding you to try to be German professors?
Yeah. And that's all. There's really nothing other than being a translator, which is one of the things that I do now. There isn't much that you can do with a doctorate in German besides teach German.
Okay.
And at the time I was like, I don't care. I'm an artist. I'm going to be a writer. So this is all just to get experience and who knows, I'll get, you know, health insurance for 5 years. So fuck it. I'll do it.
Right.
But then I actually really, it wasn't so much that I drank the Kool-Aid. Like I really did love, I liked the teaching and I liked not all of the literature, but I certainly liked most of the literature that I read. I didn't like the academic discourse itself, like professor to professor, where it really seemed like people were just sniping about minutiae all day long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's like the, I'm a beginning grad student, don't understand how it works view. Like clearly that's all it is. And now I know that. Mm-hmm. But and a lot of academics enjoyed that and good for them, but I did not. So there were certain things about the academic milieu that I really didn't like, which was sort of the colloquium talk where the person isn't actually trying to connect with the audience. They're trying to show off. And then the people who ask the questions are also trying to show off and uh-huh. everyone's just showing off and nobody learns anything. Right. And it's sad. And so I didn't want to do it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there any, when you're doing all these studies, do you talk to your professors or anything about the actual art of teaching?
Yes. Where I went at the UC Irvine, we had a pedagogue. Most German programs or language programs in general have a pedagogue and somebody who does SLA, second language acquisition. That's a whole subfield of every language study.
Okay.
And so we have a SLA specialist. His name is Glenn Levine. He's great. So we actually, not only were we mentored in our teaching, but we actually took graduate level SLA curriculum design courses. Okay. So we were actually prepared very, very well pedagogically. Mm-hmm. It's just that I also decided to do this like extremely unvoguish, very bizarre, esoteric dissertation topic that stupidly, I was like, I'm going to do a dissertation that really matters to me instead of I'm going to do a dissertation that will get me a job. So, because I figured if my dissertation was good enough, it would get me a job. And
right.
I don't know if it was, but it definitely didn't get me. People were like, your dissertation, okay, sounds a little weird. So
can you recite the full title of your dissertation?
Yeah, it's shorter than my book. SLA is a play on academic dissertation titles. That's why the title of my book is so long, because it's like a joke academic treatise title. Yeah, my dissertation was very pretentiously titled in like the title before the colon was in German, and then the thing after the colon was in English. So the German title was In der Sprachkolonie, which is a play on words. The German title for the Kafka story In the Penal Colony is In der Strafkolonie. So the word Straf means punishment.
Okay.
And so mine is In der Sprachkolonie. So it's in the language colony. And then colon, Franz Kafka's world and the limits of language. So it was all about the different ways that Kafka used language to show the limits of what language can actually do.
That is,
and it was Ludwig Wittgenstein, because why, as you do.
Well, that is impressively short, I have to say.
It was. I did that on purpose. I was like, I'm going to have an awesome, pithy, really fun German, you know, dissertation title that everyone's going to appreciate.
Yeah. Appreciate quotes.
And then when I turned it into a book, I made the book even pithier. And the book is just called Kafka and Wittgenstein. Because I wanted to be the first Google result anytime anyone Googled those two people together.
Is it?
I don't know, because, you know, everybody's Google is optimized based on what they search a lot. So sure. If you search Kafka and Wittgenstein and it comes up first for you, mm-hmm. then maybe.
Okay. That's way too specific, though.
Yeah. I mean, if someone who's never searched me searches and finds it, mm-hmm. then maybe my work is done. But clearly it will come up that way for me because I'm me and there's a lot of me-related stuff on my computer. Because I'm an egomaniac.
Why is that? Why is there so much Rebecca Schumann stuff on Rebecca Schumann's computer? I'd like to know.
Yeah.
You get – within the program, how big of a program is this that you're in as a doctoral student?
Oh, small, very, very small, which I thought was great because it would give me a lot of individual attention. I wouldn't have to compete against very many people because mm-hmm. I don't really like competing. I'm a really non-competitive person.
Okay.
So I wanted to just have friends and I wanted every – you know, I didn't want to have to jostle for anybody's attention. Uh-huh. And there were actually more faculty than doctoral students when I went, so I certainly didn't have to jostle for anyone's attention. But it was also such a small program that is very well regarded mm-hmm. In the German studies world. So, you know, I think it was probably top 10 program when I was in it. And since then has been, as many programs have, downsized possibly into non-existence. I don't know. But so it was perfectly good program, but it was very small. And I think my cohort had 3 people in it and 2 of them dropped out my first year, so I was just alone.
Oh, wow.
And then there was one person who was a year ahead of me, and then 2 people who were 2 years ahead of me. And so, I mean, there was like the whole program could fit on 2 hands.
Wow.
Yeah, tiny. Well, it's a tiny field.
Yeah, yeah. With that many people. If you're at – when you're at the school, does it feel like you have a lot of – you said you have a lot of – like there's more professors than grad students.
Yeah.
But does it – are you still like trying to get to fight for them at all, or are you – I mean how no. particular do you get to be at that point?
Fair. At that point, I mean I just got to work with – I went there to work with a particular person. He was delighted to work with me. I just worked with him the whole time I was there and we had a wonderful relationship.
Great.
There's no, but he was at the time, it was a great personal move, but it was a very poor strategic move because he was an untenured assistant professor when I got there and just got tenure when I left. And he's like even more of a hate the academic mover and shaker world misanthrope than me. So he did not have any connections to exploit on my behalf when I went onto the market. And so, you know, the other people, I made sure that all the other people on my committee were my department's famous people.
Right.
And they pulled in as many, you know, as many things as they could. But when it came down to it, you know, in German especially, your dissertation advisor is actually called your Doktor Vater or your Doktor Mutter, your doctor parent. And so you're like very much in the shadow of your parent. And so if your parent is somebody that nobody's heard of, they don't give you as much of a second look.
Sure, yeah.
It's an extraordinarily, it's even more paternalistic than your average field is. And I wouldn't do it any differently, because I still really, I mean, I went to UC Irvine to work with his name's Kai Avers. I went to university. I went to that place to work with him. I really got a tremendous amount out of working with him. He's incredibly brutal, but really brilliant and just absolutely tremendous. But so, and I never had to jostle with anybody to get any of his attention. He had plenty of time for me.
Great.
As did everybody else. So it was like really ideal in that way.
That's great. And at this point, are you even, are you just thinking, this is great. This is like every situation. I'm just going to roll right into a job. This is going to,
I certainly never thought I would roll right into a job,
okay,
but I thought I might at least have the chance to interview for a job. Mm-hmm. And my first year on the market, I did not get a single interview, not for a visiting, not for a lectureship, not for a tenure track, nothing. And so I was like, really just sad. I wasn't entitled. I wasn't like, how did this happen? Because I'm so smart. I had a Fulbright. I was this and that. Like, I wasn't none of that. None of that at all. Mm-hmm. I was like, I must be terrible. What's wrong with me? This is terrible. I mean, I gained a bunch of weight. I spent most of the time just like crying and eating chocolate chip pancakes. And because I was on fellowship at the time too, so I didn't have to do anything except for write my dissertation and be on the market and feel sorry for myself. So that's all I did. And
so how would you work the percentages there of those three things?
I would say 40% market, 50% self-pity, 10% dissertation.
Okay.
Just in that last, just for those last few months. And then, you know, at some point I just sort of snapped out of it, and then I went to like 90% dissertation.
Oh, okay. Well, that's better.
Yeah. No, I had no problem filing my dissertation on time, and it was fine. But my first year on the market, when I didn't even get – so again, I certainly never thought I would waltz into a job, but I hoped to get the chance to show my stuff and compete for a job.
Yeah.
And when I wasn't even able to do that, it was heartbreaking.
Oh, yeah.
So I wasn't mad and I wasn't entitled. I was just super sad. I was just heartbroken. I felt like I had failed everybody who had ever supported me. I felt like they had all supported a loser, and I let every single – I felt like I had let, like, at that point, like 20 people down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it was really hard to pull out of that. And so I managed to scrape – I moved to St. Louis and moved in with my partner and managed to scrape by adjuncting that first year. And then halfway through that first year, then I got the ACLS fellowship. And I really thought I was saved. I was like, that's it. I'm saved. Mm-hmm. This is it. I've been anointed. It's going to be okay. And it wasn't. But I mean, for 2 years it was okay. But one of the things that was bad about it was that I had to go on the market for the rest of it. So I was on the market for 4 years in a row. And the second year I had one interview for a non-tenure track job. But I was like, to me, that was so great because I was like, I exist. Someone in German studies wants me.
A phone interview or on campus?
It was for a lectureship. So it was a phone interview, but it happened to be at the same time as MLA. So I made it to their short list, and they basically informally called me up at MLA to go hang out with them.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
So then they canceled that position. So I didn't have to get rejected for it. And then that position reappeared as a tenure track position the year after that I didn't make the list for, but one of my friends got that job. And so I'm pretty happy for him. But that was the year I got the ACLS thing, though. So the fact that nothing else on the market mattered, like, worked out didn't matter because I felt like I got the jackpot. Mm-hmm. And then the year after that, I got one interview, but it was for a tenure track job, and it was at the convention. So it was like I felt like I'd finally made it onto the big stage. And then the year after that, I got two tenure track interviews and one on campus. So every year I incrementally got a little bit closer, but also more alienated from the field in general, where I loved the literature and I loved the teaching, but I didn't like the academic culture at all. And I really wasn't sure I wanted to be in it.
Yeah. That's
luckily, it wasn't sure it wanted me there. So. Right.
So that's starting to dawn on you as you're...
Yes.
Okay.
And so I'm in the middle of my campus interview, which is doomed because it was an insider hire the whole time, which I didn't know until I got there. And then I was like, wow, no one's showing up to any of my stuff.
Right.
And so I'm in the middle of this campus visit, and it was just so miserable. My teaching demo was a disaster. Like, everything was a disaster. And I was just like, you know what? I don't want this. I'm walking away. And at that point, I'd been offered the chance to write thesis statement, but was wavering because I didn't necessarily want to burn my bridges completely. And I got back from the on campus, and I emailed Dan Coyce, and I was like, I'll do it. Mm-hmm. I'm done with this.
Yeah. Do you think if you stayed on maybe one more year, that would have been the, I'm just saying, you would have blocked out all the other stuff of the how much you don't want to be in this field.
Yeah.
But if you had done it like maybe one more year, that would have been the year for you to have actually gotten the job.
Probably not, because I would have had to go back to adjuncting or being on the visiting track again. Like, I wasn't in this high profile postdoc anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was this, you know, so my trajectory would have shown that I got this high profile postdoc and it didn't actually get me a tenure track job. And so that would actually look like, ooh, what's wrong with her? So probably not because of that, but also probably not because, I mean, the metaphor that I use to structure the entire book of, you know, my Schadenfreude, my non-academic book, is Kafka's Parable Before the Law, which is about a guy who comes and tries to get into a door. And there's a doorkeeper who won't let him in, and he keeps saying, I won't let you in right now, but you can come back later and try. And the guy's like, okay, what a good idea. And he just keeps trying and trying and trying, and he never gets in, but he keeps being told to come back later. And then finally at the end, the guy's about to die, and he asks the doorkeeper, like, you know, all these years, nobody else has tried to come in, and I don't understand why not. And the doorkeeper says, well, this door is just for you. So the door is just to not let the guy in.
Oh, wow.
And I sort of felt like by the end of my time in the academic sphere that it sort of existed to not let me be a part of it. And, you know, it all fits in together because the German culture that I loved so much was always so indifferent back to me, and sort of it sort of exists to be loved by me and not return it, just like the guy in high school that I fell in love with for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean it's great when your life is like this perfectly symmetrical trajectory. It's just probably not great when it's tragic.
Right yeah. The one thing when I was reading your columns, I kept noticing that when you apply for jobs for your field,
yeah,
I keep seeing something like a 60-page
dossier. Yeah.
I need some explanation. I'm not sure I'm following.
Yeah, so that's your CV, your cover letter, mm-hmm. and both of those together make about 5 pages. Then you have to do a teaching statement, and that's like another 3 pages. Mm-hmm. Then you have to do a research statement. That's another 3 pages. Then you have to do several sample syllabi. Then you have to do all, you know, several classes worth of teaching evals, and then you have to do a writing sample.
Okay. So it's all combined.
And so it's all combined, and the problem is that every institution wants something different. And so some of them want a writing sample of X length, and some of them want a Y length. Some of them want a teaching statement that focuses on one thing. Some of them want something that focuses on something else.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them have a research statement that they want a very specific trajectory laid out on. Some of them want a description of your dissertation. Like, it's everybody wants something different.
Sure.
And so not only is every dossier very long, but it's often done uniquely. Just you spend like 10 hours applying for one job for a place that might not even, your application might not even make it out of HR.
Right. Yeah. I I know that feeling. Maybe not as many pages, but the...
Well, you know, you still have to do all sorts of other things in your field, right? You have to send recordings and mm-hmm. Often specific ones about stuff that you might not have. And you have to often get together equipment to make recordings of stuff, I bet.
Yeah.
Oh, speaking of which, some jobs want you to send a recording of yourself teaching. So that's right. Also.
Yeah.
Also a thing.
Do they ever tell you which direction? Do they want it from your the picture of the class or the picture of you?
I don't know. I don't know. That's so important, though. It's true.
Yeah. You see them all, like, falling asleep or texting, and you're like, no, yeah. Turn around. Wait a minute. I put this on the – this is on selfie mode. I totally screwed this.
Yeah.
The other thing is with the positions that post for your field, how much variance is there from position to position in terms of what they're actually asking you to teach?
Very little.
Okay.
In a field so small as mine, you're basically going to be teaching, if it's at a small liberal arts college, you're going to be teaching the first year sequence, the second year sequence, and then one or two upper level courses, but strong, like maybe multiple units of the first or second year sequence. Mm-hmm. At a bigger, like Research One school with a graduate program, you're going to be teaching the third year sequence, the senior sequence, and graduate courses. At a tuition dependent state school, you're going to be teaching the first and second year sequence.
Sure, yeah.
Primarily. Yeah, so every profile, like a school's profile, will dictate the courses that you teach, and they're all the same. The books are different, and so you, like the first year you teach them, it'll be a lot of work, but after that, it's all the same.
When you're saying the sequence, these are all of the how to speak and write German courses?
Yeah, German 101, German 201.
Mm-hmm.
Etc.
Are you, when you, the third and fourth year, are those still the same, in the same vein, or are you now you do?
No, those are generally what we call the content courses. Okay. So that's, but there's a canon. So you're going to teach whatever your specialty is, mm-hmm. you'll teach courses in that. So if your specialty is like mine, 20th century, then you'll teach courses in 19th and 20th or 20th and 21st. And then you'll also, everybody has a broad survey ready to go.
Yeah, yeah.
As they're just a general introduction to literature.
So you would have your Kafka on the dance floor course.
Yep. And then several modernism courses, and then a general introduction to German literature and culture course, and then a 101, a 201, a literature for beginners, a cultural studies for beginners. It's all pretty standard.
Okay. Are they expecting you to do a lot of the teaching in these upper levels in German and English? How do they?
Always all German.
Okay.
Even at the first year level, you only speak in English if you're explaining really complicated grammatical concepts, and you try to get most of that done either over email or in the book. The general language of instruction in any college German program should be German.
Got it. When you get mad in these courses, do you swear in German too?
Yes, everybody wants to know that. And get mad in German, it's all very stereotypical looking. Getting you yelling at people in German is very exactly how you think it's going to be.
Does it feel good though, Rebecca?
No.
Oh, okay.
I don't like being mad at students.
No. But what about if you're mad at them in German?
No.
Oh no.
No.
Oh, okay. Well, I thought maybe in a different language it would be like an acting exercise or something.
Not really.
No. Yeah. That's I'm disappointed, frankly.
Well, maybe that's different from other people, but.
Okay. That's good. So, this is just because I thought it was interesting when we were kind of emailing each other. You did say, you were like, all right, well, you know, music-wise, my mom played an instrument, right? Is that what you said?
She does, still.
Okay. What'd she play?
Violin.
Oh, nice.
She runs her own chamber group.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh, that's great.
Yeah, and she's 70. She's 70. 70 years old.
Still in Oregon?
Still in Oregon. She runs the premier chamber group of the Eugene Springfield area.
Wow.
Yeah, my mom is a real doer. She sort of, when she wants something, she wants an opportunity, she makes it for herself. Mm-hmm. And that's probably how I actually ended up bouncing back from my fail to bring it all back full circle.
Sure.
So I can go rescue my mother-in-law from my kid.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think that my mom's ability to, because my mom also never made it onto the tenure track as an English professor, and I watched lots of different institutions take advantage of her and not treat her very well. And
yeah.
I watched her bounce back and just invent the life that she wanted over and over again.
Yeah.
And so I think that maybe I had that model to do. And that's why I was able to sort of take all those opportunities and see which one worked for me the best and have it all work out the way it did.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I got lucky, especially with my book deal. I got extraordinarily lucky. Publishing is just like academia, but even rarer to succeed in. Mm-hmm. That if, you know, people get book deals with terrible books all the time, people with great books have their books not do well. People with terrible books become bestsellers. Like, it's just like any other, it's just like any other field, and mostly due to luck. So I don't want anybody to think like, oh, well, you know, I got my book deal and wrote my book because I'm awesome. Like, it's not because I'm awesome. I hope the book is good. I hope that people like it, but I got lucky.
Yeah. No, excellent. Do you have a few minutes to do some random ass questions?
Yes. And then you
gotta go rest. Okay, that's fine. That's fine. I do, because I do finish my podcast with random
ass questions. Yeah, I like random ass questions.
Okay, good. Good. Well, this was a little bit more centric or a little bit more timely here, but are you excited for Oregon's men's basketball team playing in the Final Four?
I guess. I mean, this is the first I'm hearing about it. So.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm kidding. It's all over my social media. I guess I'm not a big fan of college sports. I think that generally universities give too much emphasis on their sports. But my brother is a big Duck fan, and he disagrees and thinks that sports are good for universities. So if he's listening to this, I guess this is a good jumping off point for him to send me a bunch of trolley texts.
There you go. Awesome. Let's see. What is your biggest kitchen mess up?
Sorry, I just happened to have one really recent.
Oh, good.
My daughter turned two months ago, and she spent like a month before her birthday telling me she wanted a particular kind of cake. She wanted a white cake with froggy frosting.
Okay.
So she wanted me to put a picture of a frog on her cake. So I'm not a big baker, but I went to – we live right near an IKEA, actually. I have an IKEA I can walk to, which is like – digression, but it's the best thing in the whole world. So I bought like a cake pan and a mixer and stuff at IKEA, and I looked up recipes for coconut cake from scratch so I could make her a really white cake. So I'm getting the batter together, and I spend like a bajillion minutes creaming butter and sugar together because it's a hand mixer. Mm-hmm. So I'm creaming butter and sugar on the hand mixer, and I aggravate my carpal tunnel, but I finally get it to a great consistency, and it's time to dump the vanilla in. But I'm a little sleep deprived and I'm a little zonked. So right next to the vanilla in the cabinet is a bottle in a similar color of tea tree oil.
Oh.
And without thinking, I take the tea tree oil and even put it into the teaspoon and I dumped it into the batter. And then suddenly I'm like, that vanilla is really light colored. And then the smell hit me and I was like, fuck. So I thought briefly about like trying to wash it off.
Oh, no.
And then finally, my husband just ran back out to the store for me, and he just got everything new. He got butter, sugar, egg. Like, he just rebought all of the ingredients so that I could make my kid her fucking froggy frosting. But the whole kitchen smelled very strongly of tea tree oil for a long time.
That's a good one. I like that. That was solid.
Yeah. She did eat some of the cake when it was finally done, though. And so I guess it worked out okay.
Yeah.
Because it's really hard to get her to eat anything, so.
Let's see. Great movie, terrible movie.
First Trainspotting, second Trainspotting?
Oh.
Actually, I haven't seen the second Trainspotting, so maybe the second Trainspotting is great. Okay, let's see. Great movie, first Trainspotting.
Mm-hmm.
Terrible movie. What's the Avatar? That's the one or that everybody likes. Avatar is terrible.
Yeah, it was fun in the theater, like with all the things flashing in your face.
To be the big deal that it was, I thought it was really self-important. I think all the movies that James Cameron makes are really self-important. I don't like Titanic either. I also really don't like the whole violent tough guy mobster oof, so I'm not a big fan of Casino or any of those other movies. Like, pretty much any movie that overuses Gimme Shelter is not going to be a movie that I like.
Oh, right.
It's a great song. I'm like, this movie sucks. Scorsese, and it sucks. The Wolf of Wall Street is also a terrible movie in that regard, and it uses that song a lot. So makes sense.
I see. It's a very specific thing that turns you off on a movie.
But I really love Trainspotting, and I haven't had time to see the new Trainspotting yet because I have a 2-year-old and she doesn't really let me out of the house. And when I have paid childcare, I have to do my aforementioned very focused working. But I loved the first Trainspotting so much 20 years ago that I wrote this very breathless review of it for my college newspaper. That was so over the top that the All – oh, no, it was the All. Yeah, the All recently let me just republish the 11 worst lines from it with no commentary.
Oh, good.
It was just like 11 lines from my 1996 college newspaper review of Trainspotting.
Yeah. Which I'm sure at the time you thought was the
greatest thing ever. Oh, I thought it was like Pulitzer. I was like, they're going to give a college writer a Pulitzer for the first time ever. Because I get Trainspotting so well.
That was good. All right. Lastly, what one piece of art, music, movies, books, podcasts, YouTube clips, theater, has impacted you the most recently?
Let's see.
Second Trainspotting. No, I'm sorry.
I wish. I haven't seen it. Let's see. I recently read a memoir by the sort of enfant terrible addiction writer Kat Marnell called How to Murder Your Life. And it was very – her descriptions of her meth addiction were extremely evocative and made me very relieved that I've never – had that particular affliction. But it's a very interesting addiction memoir that's also like the memoir of somebody learning to be a writer who's never able to write without the crutch of amphetamines. She's always getting in her own way. One of the reasons that she gets so hopped up on drugs to begin with is that she's such a perfectionist with her writing that she just can't let something go. And so even though I have nothing in common with this person and am myself very square and have never really done many drugs and I've never had any trouble making deadlines, I was interestingly very, very moved by her story.
Great.
Many, many thanks to Rebecca Schumann for being up for doing the show. I wish her all the success and lots of sales for her book. Go out and buy it now. Right now. Amazon, right now. Do it. I think you'll be happy that you did. This week's rave is a little-known 1964 movie called One Potato, Two Potato. If you've paid any attention to my Facebook feed, again, you really should. I post here and there about the greatness of the channel, Turner Classic Movies. In the midst of showing your standard classics, they'll have a night where they play classic comedies, including a night where they showed Top Secret, This Is Spinal Tap, and Strange Brew, all super-duper classics. And then they'll throw in a movie that no one's heard of that's generally really good. This is one of them. One Potato, Two Potato is the story of a white woman and black man who find love in the early 1960s and the difficulties their relationship puts on their families and the town they live in. It involves the struggles of the local community to accept their family as is, especially as it grows. The movie is filmed in a documentary style on a small budget and features few actors of broad popularity. The most famous actor from the movie is Richard Mulligan in his feature film debut, who is better known for being the lead in the 1980s sitcom Empty Nest and the Blake Edwards film SOB. The movie also features a performance from Robert Earl Jones, a film and theater actor better known as being Darth Vader's father, as in his son is James Earl Jones. I'm not sure where to tell you to find this, except to say that if it shows up again on Turner Classic Movies, check it out. Thanks again for listening. You can find the show on iTunes, where you can leave a comment and a rating. Please do so. The show notes and links can always be found on the homepage at petezambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episodes. The podcast can also be found on SoundCloud and Stitcher. If you're on Facebook, like the page, Pete's Percussion Podcast. I will see you next time when my guest will be North Carolina A&T Assistant Band Director and Percussion Instructor Lamon Lawhorn. Until then.